Welcome back to the Break Out of Your Lane podcast. I'm so, so excited to have John Bugs on the show. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate you for having me. I'm grateful.
Yes. First of all, congrats on winning an Emmy for your work as a choreographer on the show Blindspotting on Stars. So John Bugs is an acclaimed movement artist, dancer, choreographer, writer, director. There's so many hats. Yeah. You're literally wearing one right now.
I know. Yeah, definitely. I love everything about creating, you know, creating art. And so like, there's really not one aspect of the industry that I don't like. I love producing. I love writing. I love directing. You know, I just obviously the passion for it started with movement and choreographing. So yeah, it's dope.
Yeah. So, I mean, I watched your amazing episode on the Netflix series Move. And if you have a chance to watch it, I highly recommend it. But if you could just talk a bit about how you got into dance and movement, your focus is popping in that dance style. If you could talk about that journey coming from Miami to LA and how you were able to, you know, find that creative medium and how you.
I got to give my mother a lot of credit. You know, when I was young, she used to make me watch videos of James Brown. And then we also had this movie, this Michael Jackson movie called Moonwalker. It's called Moonwalker. And she also had the making of Thriller. So I'm like a 5-6-year-old kid.
Right.
And sometimes I guess to like get me from maybe running around, she would pop that in and like I would just be glued to the TV, you know? And so Michael Jackson is was my first original inspiration for wanting to get into dance. I mean, the way he moved on stage and the way he performed just seemed like magical to me as a kid. But I was always like this history buff kind of guy where like anything I did, I wanted to know where it came from, you know? So I remember asking my uncle, like, what is that dance he's doing? You know what I mean? And my uncle was like, oh, there's some guys that used to do this on Soul Train, you know, back in the 70s. And that's when he introduced me to the Electric Boogaloos, the Lockers. Like, he had VHS tapes of Soul Train. And so I would be watching that stuff as a kid, and I stumbled across Poppin' Pete, Skeeter Rabbit, Boogaloo Sam, Boogaloo Shrimp, Shabadoo. These are like legendary street dancers. And I started discovering these guys around 10, 11, 12 years old. And from that point on, I became really obsessed with the craft. And then when I was living in Maryland, right outside of Baltimore at the time, it was just like a big thing everybody was doing in the neighborhood. Like everybody was popping. It was just like a thing. And so I really got a shout out for it. Yeah, Corey Ruff and Bobby Digital. They were my brother's age. My brother, I only have one brother. He's like 3.5 years older than me. But so I used to hang kind of in spaces and places I was too young to be hanging at the time. But like,
okay.
I was hanging with my older brother. And I remember seeing Corey and Bobby and Raheem and Richie. These are all neighborhood guys. People wouldn't know who they are. They're not big name dancers. But to me, they were superstars in my hood at the time. And I'm like, I want to get as good as them. And they also sent me on a path and gave me tapes and DVDs of Mr. Wiggles and all these legendary dancers to help my progression.
Wow,
then you fast forward, I moved to Miami. And Miami was like, obviously, a huge culture shock, you know, coming from Philly and Baltimore. You come to Miami, it's so much island influence. It's a whole melting pot of different islands. You got Bahamians, you got Haitians, you got Jamaicans, you got Cubans, you got everybody out there. And the street dance scene was really big in Miami when I moved out there. And so I naturally kind of picked up where I left off in Maryland because I was already diving into it and super like inspired to want to get good. And then Miami took my skills to the next level. And that's where I got introduced to just the ability to perform it. Like at first it was like, oh, this is just something I'm into. And then when I got to Miami, it was like a whole scene for it. And there was a little like, you know, entertainment scene as well, to be like, oh, you can actually make a living being an entertainer. Mm, like, yeah. I can actually do this for real. And this is all I want to do. You know what I mean? And so naturally, the next progression was Los Angeles, you know, and I moved out to Los Angeles in 2009. And I was living with five of my friends in a one bedroom apartment till 2014. Mm. So I did 5 years of me and the homies living on top of each other. We were taking buses to go street perform at Third Street Promenade in Santa Monica. And that was a really tough time period. It shaped a lot of character. It really, there are a lot of ups and downs, and really talking with yourself and saying, is this something I really want to do? Is this something I'm really committed to? And I just never gave in. And, you know, a blessing came, you know, and Michael Jackson's estate has a Cirque du Soleil show out here in Las Vegas called Michael Jackson One. And I got discovered by one of the casting people while I was street performing. And they told me, like, yo, just send a video to this email and we'll see what happens. At that time, I'm being honest, I was like, I thought it was some bullshit, you know, like just being real. I'm like,
like a scam.
Yeah, you know, because at that point, you're struggling, you know, you out there street performing every day, you're kind of questioning yourself, you're a grown man, you're like, man, should I have went that way or went that way? But I also was like, all right, well, let me just send the video. Who knows? Let's just see what happens. And then I got offered a contract, and that changed my life, because then I moved to Vegas. I finally had health insurance, money, just things to like stabilize, because I realized I had so many ideas in my head that I couldn't get out because I just didn't have money. I didn't have the resources. So it's like
in survival mode. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so like all these dreams are building up in my head and I can't see them come to fruition. And Cirque du Soleil allowed me to kind of go to the art school that I never went to, because I never went to a film school or an art program or none of that. Everything I learned was in the street and then trial and error, you know? So Cirque gave me not only the financial stability to start to put the ideas out that I saw in my head. It also gave me an experience to see a production with hundreds of millions of dollars put into it and seeing how it works, how it navigates, like who, what, where, when, why, stage managers, lighting, like all these different things. So I felt like I went to college for performing arts with Cirque in a way. And from there, the rest, you know, I created a film while I was in Cirque, and that film kind of popped off. It was called Color of Reality.
Is it the Color of Reality short film?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that film is phenomenal.
Thank you.
If you it's on YouTube. I watched it and I was so impressed with the concept of it, because unfortunately the topic of police brutality, especially in Black and Brown communities, is very well covered, I feel like, in a lot of art forms, but this was the first time where I felt like, wow, like I never really seen it depicted in this way before.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about your inspiration to go into being more behind the camera and also performing?
Yeah, I mean, I think my LA experience, you know, like it was one of those things where like I noticed a lot of artists, especially street dance artists, they're usually waiting for someone to bring them an opportunity. You know, I started to catch on, like, everybody's hoping that that choreographer will call them or that person will reach out. And I've always been, you know, maybe it's an East Coast Philly mentality or something that rubbed off, but I was like, oh, I want to create my own opportunities. Like, why can't I be the director? Why can't I be the choreographer? It felt like sometimes a certain style of movement was more considered. I'm like, choreography is anything that's synchronized. You can have tap choreography, popping choreography, salsa. Like, choreography is just something that's structured and organized with movement. And so I realized it was starting to be stereotyped on street dancers are just the freestylers. They're the ones who just
it's not structured. There's nothing to choreograph there.
Yes, which I think is a very I don't know the word, but it's just a not the right mentality, shall we say?
Right.
And so I was like, and my mother, getting back to my mother, not only did she have Thriller and all that, she would make me watch Color Purple, Roots, Schindler's List. So she would make me watch a lot of these deep films as a kid. And wow. So when I got to LA, I was like, I love films so much. And I love these deep narrative films, but I love street dance. How can I merge my love for this and my love for this and bring them together? And so to be honest, Color of Reality, just being real, I was winging it a little bit. Everything I saw was in my head.
Yeah.
And that was like my first real, not my first stab as a director, because I had did a couple shorts in LA, just trial and error, really like ugly short films that I'll look back at and laugh at in the, you know, when I watch them. But it was just me trying to figure out how to be a director without any guidance, without any tools. And so I'm YouTubing or Googling things on how this works, or I'm asking friends, like, how does that lens work? How does, like, so everything was just like, I'd be on set for another job and I wouldn't be paying attention to my role as a dancer. I'd be looking at what the director's doing, right?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So everything was kind of like learning as I go. And then I started to, you know, get around more intelligent directors and people who've been doing it for a long time. And so that's kind of how I slowly transitioned. It's always been there to want to be a director, to want to lead a production.
Yeah.
It just, my way was a little bit more organic in a sense of like some of my first short films of me just going for it happened to get some traction, which was like a testament to like what was up here for such a long time. It just took, I just took a different route on how to learn it. So yeah, it still trips me out to this day. when I'm directing a commercial or I'm directing something and like people ask me how I got into directing.
Yeah.
And I always have this like, you know, kind of like more abstract journey, you know, than the average person, because I didn't have it like that. You know what I'm saying? So I had to figure it out.
But there's something about being self-taught as a creative, because it shows how you're able to be resourceful, right? Mm-hmm. And just bringing all the experiences that you've had, whether it's from Cirque du Soleil or being on set as talent. I think you hear so many actors or people who aren't directors who do have a lot of experience being on set and using that experience to basically create their own film school. So I feel like you've done that as well, which is awesome.
Yeah. I'm grateful, man. I'm very grateful. So many dope people that I got to like watch and see how they do it. And also just grateful for the mistakes too, you know, like the trial and error, just watching yourself be like, man, that shot was horrible. Or like, or we could have did this better, or could have did that better. Or like understand the importance of sound design and coloring, all that post-production stuff. You know, sometimes when I was younger, I was just itching to get my idea out in the world and not having that patience to like make sure every detail of the film is how you want it. And so it's like, just learning from like all the mistakes and the errors, and I'm still learning. I still feel like I'm always a continuous student of the game. You know what I'm saying? But yeah.
Yes, always learning, always growing. I kind of want to go back to when you were talking about doing the street dancing in LA, and I'm sure you know your career is in a much higher place now. But what keeps you motivated, or what kept you motivated during those times where it was really hard? Like, I feel like for a lot of creatives who are, you know, emerging or making their way, and I'm talking to myself here too, it's like, oh man, like there's some moments where you're like, oh man, like this is tough. Like, how do you keep the motivation?
Man, I can't lie. I have an abnormal capacity of like competitiveness and ambition, you know, just being honest. Like, I came from a space of street dance where it's kind of battle culture and after a while I felt like I outgrew that, you know what I mean? But at the same time, I still kept that energy of it and said, right, well, I'm going to compete instead of competing against each other and trying to devour each other, and, you know, let, how do we get more Tony Award winning Broadway shows with street dance? How do we get more Oscar, you know, films with our vernacular at the forefront? Mm. So, like, I still bring that energy of the street dance world anywhere I go, where I'm competing for a bigger payoff, which is cultural currency. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like, stuff you can't put a value on. I want to see the culture elevate to the prestige that I know it deserves. And for some reason, I've always had that mindset, even when I was broke. You know what I'm saying? So that was always the mission statement, even then. And was like, if we just keep at it, it's like something's bound to happen. You know what I'm saying? And on a more intimate level, I'm very thankful for my mother and my friend group that was with me at that time, all living in that apartment, because sometimes when we're all struggling together, we're all having anxiety and thinking about what the hell are we doing? There's some sort of comfort in that to a degree, because you don't feel like you're alone in what you're dealing with. So I think my competitiveness and ambition, on top of my support system who was living with me at the time, that was like the proper balance. And then God, you know, God giving me signs throughout that journey, like, nah, just keep going this way. Yeah. You know what I mean? And so I think it's my faith, my support system, my competitiveness and ambition. I think those things kept me like not feeling like, but there were some nights. There were some nights for sure, you know. So but
yeah, absolutely. But that mission statement of elevating the art of street dance, street culture, I think is so incredible. And the fact that that's kind of been your mission through all the work that you've done, including creating, you know, a whole company, right? A dance company. Yeah. Could you talk about that experience and building that with your partner, Little Buck? Because it was really cool hearing about his journey with juking and the whole I didn't know what juking was. I was like, what is that? And just seeing the way he moves and then how you guys complement each other and build a platform for all these street performers to elevate the art form in spaces that people may think it doesn't belong. If you could talk a bit about that.
Well, Buck, I met Buck when I first moved to LA. We were street performing together, you know, so he was one of the people I was street performing with. Buck just blew up a little faster than we did. Like he went on tour with Yo-Yo Ma and then went on tour with Madonna. And like, so he was one of the first out of our friend group to kind of, you know what I'm saying? And we didn't really talk as much because he was so busy after a while. And then, you know, I'm still busy trying to pay rent, right? You know, so we kind of were really close and then we kind of parted. Not like we weren't close, it just life took us in different directions. And then when I came out to Cirque, when I got the Cirque du Soleil job, Buck happened to be in the same show that I got put in. And that kind of made us rekindle our friendship because we were able to hang out more, right? We're both living in Vegas at the same time and we're both doing this really cool Cirque du Soleil show. And we just started realizing like the energy that we had was still there. We were the ones that were talking about, we want to be the Fred Astaires and the Gene Kellys of our genre and of our vernacular. And like, we want to see street dancers be at the forefront of their own artistry. We don't want to see someone that's the lead of a street dance movie who hasn't lived the culture or lived the artistry. It's kind of disrespect to the form. So we were like, how do we push that forward? And we realized we just had a similar passion of where we saw the form. And so we were like, let's just start doing it. And I was really itching to write and direct.
Right.
At the time, because now I finally had money to get these ideas out. And my brain's like, we just got to make it cinematic. We got to do this. You know, I had all these thoughts of how we could achieve that. And Buck was just all for it as well and had similar thoughts and ideas. And that's when we started making Honor Thy Mother and we made Color of Reality. And then, you know, we made Am I a Man with Brian Stevenson. Shout out to Brian Stevenson, who's a lawyer and ambassador for ending mass incarceration. He was like the lead in the documentary 13th by Ava DuVernay. Yeah. So like we got to really like through just creating work that felt good at the time we got to meet real people in those spaces, and it just amplified our storytelling. It amplified our mission. And we were like, now let's create a show. Like we would look in the Broadway space and the theater space, and we're like, there's no shows that have our vernacular as the lead form of movement in their show. So I'm like, well, Buck, why don't we were going around doing these like duo performances. And I was like, why don't we take a pay cut and bring in other dancers to like show what we can do more? Like, it's cool. Cause at that time, you know, we were doing all right. So naturally you're like, you know, you could get comfortable in that space, but I was like, nah, forget that. Like let's take a pay cut and bring in more talent to show that we can choreograph multiple bodies, that popping and juking can be just as elegant and beautiful as ballet and all that stuff. And so naturally we just created a plan of like, instead of going around and doing these shows ourselves, let's empower some people that we were street performing with, that we did grow up with, people that have the talent and the ability to be in these spaces, but maybe they wouldn't be in those spaces. And that's how MAI came about. Movement Art Is, our company together. And it was just literally spawned from us, our creations together. It's MAI just started as me and him. And then we started to create a collective of movers that are under that umbrella. So when we do things, create things, like blind spotting, all these other things we've done, a lot of those dancers are in those pieces because they're kind of a part of our collective. Yeah.
No, that's so powerful to not to think larger than yourself and building that collective. And I think this idea of the art form itself, like thinking larger than just yourself, is really commendable. Let's talk about blind spotting. I mean, the show is incredible, but that episode that you eventually won the Emmy for, Niggas and Jesus, it's so such a powerful episode. Can you talk about that journey of getting, because you've worked with the showrunners before, you've choreographed for them in season one, Rafael Casal and David Diggs. Could you talk about the experience of getting involved with the show and what the thought process was for you in creating such powerful choreography? For those who haven't watched, you should watch season 2, episode 5 of Blind Spotting, where the main characters are explaining to their young biracial son about the background of the N-word and where it comes from, and just a really powerful dance sequence, kind of basically combining like hundreds of years of the slavery and segregation and police brutality. So it's a tall order for anyone, but especially for like, in what was it, 7 minutes? It was really short but really effective.
It was about a sequence. 3.5-4 minute piece.
Oh my gosh. So if you could talk about that journey of one, being involved with the show, and then crafting such a powerful piece.
Well, how we got involved with it was Rafa and Diggs came to see me and Lil Buck's theater show. We had a theater show at UCLA Royce Hall in LA, and we just invited the whole industry. Like, we had been promoting it for months and months and months, so we had no idea who was going to be in the room. And not, I'm not name dropping to brag. I'm name dropping only because we were shocked at like, oh, these people actually came to our show. You
name
know what
drop
I mean?
Away.
Like, yeah, that was crazy. So I remember like Jennifer Garner pulled up and came, Paris Goebel, Natalie Portman, Jordan Peele, Rafael Casal, David Diggs, a whole dance community. We were just like, we really wanted to try to get all the people we knew in all walks of life to come see our show, because back to the mission statement, we're trying to elevate the craft, you know, and the more people that can get eyes on it and we change the perception of how they view it, maybe it opens more doors and opportunities, right? And so after that show, Rafael invites me to his house and he's like, yo, bro, you seen, you know, I had seen Blind Spotting the movie, you know, I had seen it. And he's like, we're getting a deal with Stars to do like a TV show version of it. And we'd love to like incorporate what you guys do in it, because some of the topics we're touching on are similar to what you guys are doing in your theater show. So it seemed like a natural marriage. Like we were like speaking the same language. And so that's kind of how it happened. And then the pandemic hit and we still shot season one. And that was just a great experience of like, I think season one, we were just figuring out, because I even think Lionsgate and Stars were at first figuring out how is dance going to work in this show? Like, how does it make sense? And then luckily when we did some of our first pieces, I think we blew people's minds at what we could do. And David and them knew, you know what I mean? But obviously, you know, like everybody's got to be on board, right? You know?
Yeah.
And so season one, I feel like was more figuring out how movement works. And then season two, it felt like we kind of knew now that where the moments should go and being more specific with it so it has more impact. You know what I'm saying? And basically what happened was in the script, it says, you know, Sean uses the N-word. And then there's a history dance of the, it's like literally like just two sentences in there, like a history dance of the N-word, told to dance.
That's like, only two pages in the script.
And so we were like, it was just like kind of like a sentence
of
what it is. And then me and the director, Jess Wu Calder, we really like locked in together for like 2 months straight, you know, because even though we're shooting stuff throughout,
right,
we knew this was going to be the biggest piece, dance wise, production wise, financing, costumes, all that. So we just locked in on every aspect of the piece, you know, from historical references to music to, I was working hands on with the composers, Michael and Ambrose. Like, it was just like, she allowed me to collaborate with her in every aspect of that piece, which says a lot about her as a collaborator, but also their trust in me as a visionary, because they know also I bring a lot of skill sets to the table, you know, as a creative, you know. And so they allowed me really to spread my wings with that piece. And then I have to shout out my wife, who was my associate choreographer for the piece. So once we kind of knew what the worlds were, like, okay, we're going to have a slavery era, a civil rights era, a modern era, then I could go, okay, now I know the chronological order of our journey. Now, how do they move in each of these worlds and these spaces? And me and my wife were crafting that movement at home. And it was just a beautiful experience, because sometimes it hits me late, but I'm like, yo, we told the history of the N-word through street dance on television, and it won an Emmy. And then I'm the first Black street dancer to ever win an Emmy. So it's wild. It was just wild. And I'm forever grateful to Rafa and Diggs for giving me the platform to showcase just a sample size of what's really possible when we're given the right tools. You know what I'm saying? There's no limit to the storytelling that can happen. And I think we proved that with that. So, and Jess Wu Calder, again, the director, she just, which that whole episode, she crushed it as a director.
Oh my gosh. And that was her first episode, right? Because she's a producer on the show, but
she's a producer as well. Yeah, she's a director. She was a director in season two, but she's also been a producer of the movie and both seasons. So she's been on the blind spotting journey for a long time. It was one of those things where everybody, it was a very like collaborative team effort. And it wasn't foreign to me, because a lot of the work, as you know, Color of Reality, Am I a Man, our theater show, I had done and directed dance pieces in these same topics years prior. So it's funny how like it's just being prepared for that opportunity, right? Like I had kind of been practicing with my own productions, my theater show, my short films, and then now I get this opportunity to do it with Stars and Lionsgate. And so it felt like just hopping on a bike and riding it, because I had already been so prepped to tell those types of stories, and not just prepped like artistically, but like I've really got to sit in the trenches with real people who fight these fights on a regular basis. You know what I'm saying? Like who?
1,000%.
You know what I'm saying? So you know, I really feel like all of that experience led to that piece. And yeah, it was a beautiful experience.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you felt, yeah, that your directing and writing background helped you add a certain level of visualization to the choreography. And it seemed like it, because it felt very cinematic the way it was choreographed.
Oh, of course, of course. I mean, I did a behind the scenes piece, you know, where we went into like how we created it. And like, there was like, you know, even, you know how, I mean, I could get into it. Like,
movement, you want to do some right now?
You know, like, but it's like, you know, like, okay, an auctioneer, how they were selling black bodies back then, like how they talk real fast. I've been to auctions, 25, 25 here, 25, we got 25, whatever it is, right? And I'm like, what movement matches that character's attitude? You know what I'm saying? And so every character had a demeanor, and then there's a movement that's going to match that demeanor. You know, just like when you write characters in a script, right? You know, like, you know, this character is this, 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 but how do they talk? How do they walk? What are their mannerisms, right? And so it's the same thing, you know? And I think, like, I always go into things, no matter what my role is, bringing every skill set that I have. Even if I'm not being asked to do that, I know how to play my role, but I'm still going to think like a director, think like a writer, think like a dancer, think like a creative, because I can't help but think that way. So there was a lot of times, even, you know, when we would film rehearsals, you know, I'm working with the DP, shout out, oh my gosh, what's my guy? Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. I can't believe I'm forgetting his name. I'm so mad at myself. But no, either way, the DP and I, we would talk about how I saw, you know, dance scenes being filmed. And sometimes I would film them the way I saw them in rehearsal. And then we talk about what's actually logical with what, you know, camera we're using or lens or rig or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
So like, I really did get to flex a lot of different muscles, even though I was just the choreographer. When it came to those really powerful movement sequences, I got, they gave me a lot of love, you know, and allowed me to flex a little bit, which was great. You know what I mean? Which is super great.
It makes sense now, but the fact that you said that you are the first Black street performer choreographer to win an Emmy, do you feel like that has changed the narrative for this art form and has opened doors for you as a creative?
I think it's, yes, I think it's opened doors for me as a creative. If I'm being honest, do I think it, maybe because I'm in it, you know, I don't know, you know, but I still feel like it hasn't moved the needle the way maybe it should. Not that I felt like, that's why I was really excited to come on here and talk about the journey, because I feel like, you know, we're in Black History Month. Black History is not a month, it's every day, you know, but you know, not many people were talking about that aspect. I'm like, yo, the Emmy's been around 75 years. You know what I'm saying? And nobody from our vernacular that looks like me has won one. You know what I'm saying? And like, I felt like, oh, we should be talking about that more. And not, it could have, take me out of the equation. If it was somebody else, I'd be like, we need to be talking about that, because it's such a huge accomplishment for the culture. So yes, I think me personally, it helps. Cause I mean, yeah, of course, when you're in the meetings and people see that you're an Emmy winner, of course they were, it holds equity in our space. Right. You know what I mean? But at the same time, I still feel like we got a long way to go before truly getting Hollywood's respect in television and film and doing things, you know, how I feel could really change the culture. I still feel like we need that feature film with our art form at the forefront.
Yeah.
And it's done correctly, and the story has substance, and it has depth, and it has emotion, and it, you know, it's not just cheesy or boxing our shit into this like kind of surface based culture, when it's like, this shit really saves lives. This shit's really a healing modality for people. Stop boxing our shit in to your interpretation of what you think it is. And most people who are shaping that never lived it, right?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's kind of funny how that works. But we're not complaining. We're just being the change we want to see.
Yeah.
You know, we're not complaining. We you know, we just finished a script, you know what I'm saying? So
okay.
we're in that space. You know, I finished my second feature film script in the last 2 years. So I just kind of got tired of it and was like, it's time to write stories how I see them in my head. And then hopefully from the blessings I've gotten to meet certain people and connect with certain people as I've been directing and choreographing and doing all these things, hopefully now we'll be able to create this shift in those spaces. And so sometimes it comes with like pressure, unnecessary pressure at times, because I can't help it. You know, I talk to my therapist about it all the time. It's like, I feel like I wear the culture on my shoulders because I know so many people won't get to be in the rooms I'm in. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Whether that's in the Broadway space with the public theater or with Netflix or whatever we're doing. So I feel like this responsibility to try to be like, if I don't push it forward, how is it going to happen? And sometimes you got to have that balance of like, it's just hard. You can't,
that's a lot to take on.
Yeah, it's hard. And I try to balance self-care and also like community care and try to balance that out as best as I possibly can. But then it always goes back to, well, what was your mission statement when you first got to LA? You said you want to elevate the culture, right? You want to elevate the craft. So it's kind of a part of what you asked for. You know what I'm saying? So it's just weird. Like,
it's a balance. I think,
you're balancing that.
I think, if it's any consolation, I feel like, the fact that you have already built this community and you have, these partnerships, and I mean, I'm sure there's so many other artists that you're inspired by, in the space that are doing the work. And I mean, I know she's not a street dancer, but like the things that kind of what Solange Knowles is doing in the movement space. And I remember going to the Getty years ago and just seeing her do this beautiful like black movement piece in the Getty, you know, just having these like black and brown bodies just moving in such beautiful ways, in such a kind of like white curated space. I was like, okay, you know, there's something there. And I think she's like the first black woman to be the creative director for the ballet, I forget which one, but you know, that's one example. Are there any other artists that you're inspired by? Or I like to ask every guest, like any multi-hyphenate artists you're inspired by right now.
Man, so many.
I know, I imagine.
I mean, I'll start with my bros, you know, with the Blind Spot, and David and Rafa, both multi-hyphenated artists. Shanaka Hodge out of Oakland as well. Phenomenal writer, poet. Ava DuVernay. Why am I drawing blanks all of a sudden now? Bruce Lee, even though he's passed away, he was a huge inspiration, choreographed his movies, directed his movies, wrote his movies. You know what I mean? Like, he wore many hats. And I understand that because nobody deemed me a director. I had to just do it. You know what I'm saying? And then make something that people think is credible enough to say, yeah, well, then you are that now, right? You know?
Yeah.
So I can understand when somebody's getting it out the mud. And during his time period, you know, the Asian community wasn't getting no love. He was helping spearhead that in Hollywood with his movies and his aspirations. And so, and I'm really close with the family. So like, he's always been a huge inspiration, man. People just think of him as a martial artist, but he was a philosopher. He was a writer. He was a director. He was a choreographer, fight choreographer. I mean, he was amazing. Jordan Peele, Michael Jackson, Bob Marley. Bob Marley. Man, if I get into some actors, you know, there's a lot.
So there you go. Like, there's so many people who are pushing the culture, but the way that you're doing it with the movement art is, and what I loved about when I was watching the documentary about what y'all were doing was this idea of how dance is healing and healing kind of generational trauma in a sense. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention how we met, which was through our dear friend, Michael Latt, who passed away last year, tragically. If you could talk about how y'all met and the work that you did together in terms of bringing that movement art into the two folks who are incarcerated and how you use dance as a healing tool for them.
Oh, yeah, for sure. First time I met Mike, we went to certain prisons are like max, you know, I think there's like different levels or whatever, right? And we were in a level 3, and I think level 4 is like the highest, you know what I'm saying? And we were screening one of our friends' documentaries in there. And then Mike and Saul was like, yo, John, I think I had just recently did a short film about mental health with people of color. And it did really well. And Saul was like, man, if you could like do some performance or an excerpt of that, you know, I think it could just be so powerful for the inmates and stuff like that. And I was like, man, I would love to, you know? And so that's the first time I met Mike. And when we met, I didn't know who he was. We were just hitting it off because we were just talking about shifting culture and changing the game and changing the machine, you know, that is the industry, and trying to get real stories. And Mike was a guy who really wanted to amplify people's voices, and particularly people of color. He was a big, big advocate for that. Yeah. And so I went in there and I did a solo. And to me, to this day, that's the most powerful performance I've ever done in my life.
Wow.
Because they don't give a fuck about your accolades and all the shit you got going on. They just want to feel that you're meeting them on a human level and being honest and being vulnerable. And so that's all I kept asking myself, was like, you know, juggling that act of like, oh, I have my own traumas, and thinking about some of the things that these men are going through, and not being able to be with their families, their wives, their mothers, their fathers, like also being like, man, one mistake in my life, one bad day changed the whole trajectory of my life. Like there were so many emotions going through my head, because when you were talking to a lot of them, some people would have their own preconceived, I guess, notions of what someone in prison is like, you know, right? And you don't really know until you sit down and you speak with them and you talk with them. And, you know, people were crying together, meditating together. And to get a standing ovation from 200, 300, you know, inmates who have nothing to gain from me. You know what I'm saying? Like there's I can't explain it. It's hard to put it in words because it was like an emotional thing. And plus Mike was involved, so I'm having trouble putting a stamp on it. But like it was one of the most powerful days and one of the most powerful ways I've ever met someone. And to meet Mike in that space, we hit it off from that day. And we were on a mission to continue to do a lot of the stuff I talked about throughout this interview, you know, and he was a big advocate for it. And yeah, it's just a shame that he's not around, because to me, it's not like I lost a friend or the family lost a son or a brother. It's more like I feel like the world lost an ally to someone who was just really down to really help people, and to meet people who genuinely want to help people is like, it's very rare in this time period. And so yeah, I'm just sad. I'm sad for his family, I'm sad for his friends, and I'm sad for the people who don't get to see the light that he was. But people will still see the light, you know. Lead with love, the legacy still will continue. We're going to keep pushing his legacy and what he stood for. And Mike's still here, he's just rolling on a different vibration, that's all.
Yeah, beautifully said. Well, this was an amazing conversation. I do have one more question and then I'll let you go, because I'm sure you got a lot to do. What advice do you have for creatives who are wanting to embrace their the movement art, you know, they want to do something more performance driven, but also want to wear multiple hats, whether it's writing or directing or producing?
I think advice that I have is, one, just go for it, right? You know, go for it. You know, if you want to write, write. If you want to direct, direct. You want to choreograph, choreograph. Obviously, when you first start, you're going to be novice. You're going to make mistakes. And that's just a part of the journey. I would say, if you're the smartest person or the most intelligent person in the room, get out of that room and go to the room where you're the least intelligent person in that field, because you're going to grow and you're going to learn. And always have people that you can go to. I think it's, I mean, in this land of where people steal so many ideas, I know it's really hard for people to feel comfortable to share their work, but I would say try to create a support system of people who maybe are mentors or higher level than you in the spaces that you desire to be in. And I'm very lucky to have people I can go, hey, tell me what you think of this film before I put it out in the world.
Yeah.
And I get honest critiques and feedback, or I might ask specific, what do you think of this, the tone? What do you think of the coloring? What do you think of this or that? Like, have those people that you can feel you can get a safe enough space to share your work, to get honest feedback. Because I think in this social media world we live in, everybody wants the instant validation or the instant like, or the, you know, people, you know, sometimes people could be feeling away and then they'll just post a picture so they can get that instant love and gratification. But in reality, like, you also need that balance of like real honest feedback and understanding that, like, you know, it takes time and it takes work and it takes reps and you need people that are going to be honest with you. And so that I would say that, go for it, have a good support system you can share your art with to get some honest feedback.
Right.
And then also, on the contrary, not all feedback is good feedback. Take it with a grain of salt. Like, if you believe in your vision, there's times where I've gotten notes on things that I'm like, no, I don't want to change that. I like that because it resonates with my spirit. But then that note, sometimes when you get, you know, sometimes something can resonate as defensive, but it also has some truth in it too. So you got to be able to just be honest with yourself. That's one of the hardest things to do, you know, is be truly honest with yourself. Because it's easy to just be like, man, this shit is tight. And then once you start getting some real feedback, you know, you can sometimes be like, oh, I could improve that. I could improve that. You know, like, you know, be honest with, take it with a grain of salt, but also try to keep your heart and mind open to enhancement. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Thank you so much. And I have to say, the work that you are doing, like, it's one of those things where I feel like, okay, God put this person on this planet to do this. You know what I mean?
Appreciate
seeing
that.
The way you move, it is incredible. So I hope to see you perform it live one day.
Yeah, hopefully you're based. You're on the West Coast or East Coast?
Yeah, I'm in LA.
Okay, so you're on my side. Yeah. So yeah, we'll get it cracking when we finally get the show up and running at the Public Theater in New York. You already know I'll have you out there.
Okay, because you're working on a show. What can you talk about the show or when it's out? Or,
well, I can't talk about when it's coming out, but I could say we're in deep developments. We just finished a draft of the play, and hopefully we'll be doing a reading soon, and then from that reading we're going to figure out next steps. But we're in good space, and the draft of that script got really good feedback, so, you know, all the writers including myself are really, you know, happy that we got good feedback, and now we just got to go in there and make a few tweaks to amplify it, and then it should be moving pretty soon, and when it is, I'll definitely let you know.
Oh my gosh, amazing. Well, thank you so much, John, and appreciate you for coming to the Break Out of Your Lane podcast. Amazing.
Thank you for having me.
This episode of the Break Out of Your Lane podcast was recorded virtually with Riverside. The theme song is Pretty Carolina by Jonathan Lynx. The show is hosted, produced, and edited by Tayo Amos. Our associate producer is Aisha Holden. And that's a wrap on season 1. And stay tuned for season 2 coming soon.